Are you recording?
Yes. It started. I mean,
every single show. Hi, I'm Nicole.
And Dennis.
Welcome back to the Violet Hour podcast, a podcast where we share stories from the mysterious
and the mundane
to the mundane. Okay, so thank you so much for listening. If you're back from our last show, which was like just a really late night drunk like meandering conversation between us. So anyway, if you've not done so already and you're still here, go ahead and subscribe to our podcast. And today we're going to be discussing the history of Wonder Woman. And like, we're really going to get into the creator of Wonder Woman because it's pretty gnarly. So I've been a fan of Wonder Woman since I was like 4 or 5, and I would run around the house in my Wonder Woman underoos. And if you don't know what underoos are, I'll post a link in the show notes and a photo on Instagram. And by the way, you can find us on Instagram at Violet Hour Podcast, which is all one word. So as I said before, Wonder Woman is my girl, and I thought it would be cool to take a deep dive into how she came to be and the actual origin story of Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman first appeared way back in 1941 in a DC comic called All-Star Comic No. 8. She was a founding member of the Justice League, and Wonder Woman had her first solo feature in 1942 called Sensation Comics No. 1. The first issue of Sensation Comics also marked her first cover appearance as Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman was born in a fictional place called Temiscara. The island and city are named after the mythological town of the same name, which is the capital of the Amazons in Greek mythology. So in the Wonder Woman universe, Temiscara is a unitary and sovereign city-state, and it's like an archipelagic island nation. It's also a segregated nation of women governed by Aphrodite's law, which declared that the Amazons would be immortal so long as no man sets foot on their island. So all men are essentially banned from Temiscara under the penalty of death. And the way they ensured no man would find its way to the islands, their location is not shared with anyone. And to guarantee it remained hidden from the world, they had this really super cool security feature, which would allow the island to move over land and time. So, like, they would be undetectable from outside observers. And when people would leave the island, they would immediately forget where it was located. So eventually, the name for the entire archipelago became Paradise Islands when they renamed it for the February 1987 relaunch of the Wonder Woman comic book, which was called Wonder Woman Volume 2. And Temiscara made its cinematic debut in the 2017 film Wonder Woman and the Justice League, and appeared in the 2020 sequel Wonder Woman 1984, set in the DC Extended Universe. Do you have any questions? Like, you're being so quiet.
You're asking the crowd? I have no questions at all.
No questions?
Sounds well researched.
So, like, this is, I have 16 pages of notes. I'm warning you guys ahead of time. This is probably going to be a really long podcast.
Not if we let her read it. Go right through pretty fast.
Okay. So, now that you have the details on where Wonder Woman came from, I'm going to dive into, like, a little bit of who she is. So Wonder Woman's official name is Princess Diana of Temiscara. But when she's not being a superhero or in the land of her birth, she'll use Diana Prince as her cover name. And, you know, as an Amazonian woman, she essentially has the supernatural power of the Greek gods. And all of the women from the islands, they're all powerful and physically beautiful. But the biggest thing to note about these women is that they live in harmony, despite the fact that they spend most of their time learning how to fight and about warfare. Due to, like, the crappy things that happen outside of their world, which is, you know, the world of man. And because man's world is so crappy, the Amazonians essentially give Princess Diana to their world to fight injustice and instruct the world of man on how to live with compassion and harmony. So Wonder Woman became this symbol of truth, justice, and equality for all. And Diana's mission is to show the world, our world, of course, what it's like to live in a place without war, where everyone lives peacefully with each other. And this role or this job of hers, like, was more challenging than she probably ever expected, because man's world is completely chaotic. And it's full of crime and evil dealing. And needless to say, she's got her hands full, because humans are, like, not getting the message. So when Wonder Woman's comic was released in 1941, she was viewed as, like, a total feminist icon. She was equal to Superman and was a patriotic symbol like Captain America. She was strong, intelligent, and she had the added bonus of being, like, really hot. Wonder Woman's creator was William Moulton Marston, and he went by the moniker of Charles Moulton. And Moulton, for the time, was really, I guess what you could call progressive, in that he advocated for homosexuality, transgenderism, and fetishism, which, like, back in the 40s was not discussed behind closed doors, if at all. But it certainly did exist. Moulton had two muses who helped inspire the character of Wonder Woman. But beyond a strong female role model, there are a lot of undercurrents of sexual training that Marston purposely put into his comics and Wonder Woman. But before we dive into all of that, let's go back in time to 1893, when William Moulton Marston came into being. So every comic book superhero has an origin story. And for the creators of, you know, these superheroes, the origin stories can perhaps offer clues into Massachusetts. His parents were Frederick Marston and Annie Dalton, and they were, like, really well off. So in high school, Marston got good grades. He was the president of his class and the captain of his football team. And our team boys, like, if he existed today, they'd probably classify him as a Chad. And by all accounts, this would be an accurate, you know, contemporary description of him. He was certainly popular, and he seemed to have it all. So after high school, he attended Harvard University, and while he was at Harvard, he really experienced his first real sense of, I guess, hardship and difficulty. He struggled to get good grades, and this made him feel inadequate. And during this time, while he was at Harvard, his parents also cut him off financially. So the man was having a moment, to say the least. And at some point, he even considered taking his own life. But eventually, he landed in a class on ancient philosophy. And this is where things began to turn around for him, because he was really into the subject. His class professor was a widower of the suffragist movement, and which was considered, you know, the first wave of feminism. So this professor was an advocate for women's rights, which in the early part of the 20th century, you know, they weren't really like what they are today, I guess. Needless to say, Charles's mind was open to the idea, this idea that men and women should have equal rights, and that this was a good thing, despite the fact that there were, like, no females in any of his classes, because Harvard was still an all-male university at this time. So Charles, like, you know, like, he was getting his groove, I guess, as far as his academics and his field of study, but he still had this problem of, like, not having any money. So what he did is he began to enter, like, contests on campus that had monetary prizes. And one of these contests called for creating a new invention, and depending on how, like, good the invention is, it would determine your cash prize. And it was during this time that Marston created what he called a systolic blood pressure measuring apparatus. And this was crucial to the development of the polygraph machine, otherwise known as the lie detector test. And so Marston studied experimental psychology, and this at the time was still considered a like green branch of philosophy. He developed and breathlessly espoused theories on humanity's like basic emotions, which he later parlayed into work in Hollywood, advising filmmakers on how to tell stories with resonance. He had a lifelong talent for self-promotion and was shameless in doing so. Like, for instance, he attempted to interpose himself and his lie detector test in a famous criminal case, which was Fry versus the United States. And basically, during this case is when they basically decided that lie detectors were ruled inadmissible in court. And that precedent still stands today. Excuse me. He tirelessly hawked his precious machine also by staging publicity stunts with like hot co-eds from a nearby college. Anyway, he took his contest winnings and from a filmmaking contest he won, and he purchased an engagement ring for his girlfriend, Elizabeth Holloway. And Elizabeth went by the nickname of Sadie, and so that's how I'm going to that's what I'm going to call her from here on out. So Charles and Sadie, they actually grew up in the same social circle. Like, they knew each other from childhood, but they had no romantic interest in one another until they got to university. So, you know, again, like, Charles, Sadie came from wealth, but, like, her parents were also kind of surprisingly progressive and modern in that they pushed her to get a degree, but it was more likely probably because that would be the best way for her to find a husband that was also like up on the social financial food chains, right? Because they didn't think she'd do anything other than become a wife with her education. Sadie actually really enjoyed working. She was intelligent, and, you know, despite being smart enough to qualify for Harvard, she couldn't go because she was female. So she went to the all-female university called Mount Oak College. And there she excelled in philosophy, Greek, and mathematics. You know, and as far as her brain power, she was equal to, if not brighter than Charles. And she was pretty much his silent partner in all of his projects, including helping him create that lie detector test. And Charles did view Sadie as his absolute equal. And she did accept his proposal to marry. So both Sadie and Charles, they earned law degrees. And Sadie became a psychologist, and Charles earned a PhD in psychology. He got a job teaching at a military school in Georgia. And it was during this time that he met a woman called Marjorie Huntley, who was the school librarian. And I couldn't really find too much on her, so she played it pretty low-key. But basically, they became friends, and, you know, from what I could gather, Marjorie was a free spirit. She was a spiritualist who believed in reincarnation, free love, and love binding. So, like, it sounds like she was a legit witch to me. But anyway, she taught Charles all of these concepts, which he found, like, super interesting. And he developed this theory or idea that women's powers, like the psychological power that women have, come from connecting with love. And it's a theory he's never heard of before. And this idea is the very beginning of what Wonder Woman would become. So eventually, these two, if you haven't guessed already, have an affair. And Charles falls in love with her. He ultimately, you know, comes clean to Sadie about this relationship and with Marjorie, and surprisingly, she's perfectly okay with it, which I wouldn't be because, like, I don't share. However, even more surprisingly, she and Marjorie became friends, and the trio entered into what could only be described as a consensual, polygamous, and polyamorous relationship. Which, I mean, again, this is, like, early maybe 1920s or 30s, so it's, like, not legal or commonplace. So they kept it a secret, and, you know, the Marjorie didn't live with them. She kind of came and went as she pleased. But they had this, like, threesome. So Charles got a job working at Tufts University as a professor, and he hires this research assistant by the name of Olivia Byrne, who was studying to be a doctor. Charles needed help researching his new book about sexual freedom called Emotions of Normal People. Now, this book is described as being a comprehensive treatise on human emotion. And it's actually in the public domain, so, like, if you want to read it, by all means, go for it. It covers topics of sexual freedom, homosexuality, transgender identity, fetishism. And these, again, you have to remember, these were only topics that kind of existed in the periphery of society that were still considered taboo at the time. So Olivia turned out to be, like, the perfect research assistant for this job because she considered herself sexually liberated as a niece of Margaret Sanger. Now, you'll remember that Margaret Sanger was the eugenist and founder of Planned Parenthood, who also just happened to be, like, very racist and responsible for the sterilization of many minority women against their will during that time. So my husband's giving me, like, the side eye. So, you know, not my favorite woman in history. She's definitely not my favorite woman in history or one I'd even consider a hero. But Margaret Sanger's mentorship, but under Margaret Sanger's mentorship, Olivia became sexually liberated or perverse. It's really just a matter of opinion. Mm-hmm. So time out.
So according to what you're saying now, but based on what I'm reading, they're saying Margaret Sanger is one of the most important feminists of the 20th century.
Right, because she's responsible for abortion, and feminists think abortion is, like, the be-all, end-all of feminism, which I disagree with.
She opened the first birth control clinic in the United States.
Yeah, and so did Olivia Byrne's mother was also involved with that.
So,
but anyway, so so Olivia began taking Charles to orgies and sex parties at this school that were happening with students on campus. And, you know, she called it for research at these parties. Charles learned what the young kids were doing, but it also introduced him to some kinky shit and fetishes he wasn't even keen to. And mind you, this is a guy that was already involved in, like, a polyamorous relationship and was, like, totally into bondage and stuff. But anyway,
Level up.
He leveled up, yeah. So anyway, it wasn't long before he and Olivia were physically practicing their research, if you know what I mean. So anyway, Charles being Charles, he asked Olivia if she wanted to be in a committed relationship with he and his wife. And at this point, I'm not really sure
where's the other woman,
where Marjorie is. I think she was still flitting in and out. But Olivia was agreeable to this, and she became a permanent member of the household alongside Sadie. So, like, unlike where Marjorie would just come and go, Sadie and Olivia lived under the same roof with Charles. So Olivia did graduate, and she got her master's degree, but she never went on to be a doctor. Instead, she stayed home and cared for the threesome's children. And, you know, though they lived together, they kept their intimate details of their relationship secret. Like, they told the census people that she was the widow sister of Sadie. She told Sadie's parents that she was the housekeeper. Like, I mean, they basically lied. So privately, you know, Marston was a man steeped in what some would call contradiction, others hypocrisy. He was a devout feminist who secretly presided over a harem. He was a passionate advocate for the exposure of deceit, who habitually trafficked in lies. And, you know, he had two wives, both of whom received university.
Three.
Well, no, the other one was, like, a girlfriend. She wasn't, like, actually, like, a sister wife. You know?
They are all are.
So,
it's like 1920. I mean, name a TV show. Like, it was built around this guy's life.
It's crazy.
Modern TV today.
So Marston.
Let me see. From, you can't even think. What is
Three's
it?
90, Company.
90 Day Fiance.
Three's Company was the one I was company. Thinking of. But they were just new roommates, right? So anyway.
What's that? Sister, wife, or sister, whatever it's called. So, I don't know. I'm just listening to,
so, okay,
to your
right.
Research.
So, I mean, he, like, literally, he had these two women who were, you know, educated. They received university educations equal to his. And they were both consigned to living in his professional shadow, which to me is not essentially a feminist thing, right? Like, it's really hypocritical. So Sadie, Elizabeth Holloway, was his public wife. And his marriage to his former student, which, again, cringy, Olivia Byrne, was kept a secret from the world, as I said earlier. But he fathered children with both of these women.
It's not cringy. They all agreed on
it. It's cringy. I don't share my man. I'm sorry.
That was what
like,
they...
Like, if you're into it, no judgment, but it's not, like, something that
no,
I would...
No, the other person was not she.
So, I don't know.
I don't believe like, again, she was into like, it, but he said he's going to leave her.
You know, no harm, no foul, I guess. So, you know, I don't know. I just think, like, he's supposed to be this feminist person, but, like, I don't know. So, anyway, he fathered children with both of the women, and, you know, Byrne's children, they were told that Byrne, which is Olivia, they were told that their father had passed away, and they didn't learn about their true parentage until, like, the 1960s.
How old were they?
They were grown by then, right?
That's the best time to tell them.
So, nevertheless, this unconventional brood, they lived happily together under one roof, as far as I could tell.
Well, I'm saying that's the best time to tell these kids, because you don't want to messed them up. Imagine.
Well, I don't know. Like mentally, you know. Like, so, Marston cycled through jobs. Like, he was a professor, a lawyer, a novelist, an advertising copywriter, and Olivia's publishing career helped support the family too. And I think Sadie also worked. She was a lawyer and a psychologist. So the women really helped support him as he flitted through all these different, you know, trying to make his way to Wonder Woman. So, you know, Olivia also also looked after this untraditional home. But she had a regular gig writing for Family Circle, espousing traditional home life. So she would write about women's interests, which include, you know, motherhood and homemaking.
But was she the creator of that, what's it called? That magazine or whatever back then, How to Be a Good Wife. I forget the name of that.
Yeah, like it was like this kind of shit, you know.
How to be a good wife so during like, the 1950s.
Like, you know,
make sure that your home man.
Can you just imagine, like, our
to,
grandmother is reading this stuff, and then they're like,
make sure that your man comes to a nice cooked
you know?
Meal.
I mean, but it's also like for me, like this is so American. I don't know. In fact,
as American as apple pie.
You know, like it really is. I don't know. It's just weird. So, in
again,
fact.
It's not gonna be a racist joke now, but white people. That's white all I gotta say. White people.
In fact, Olivia, like she did a lot more than just write these, traditional like homemaking and motherhood articles. She really set out to burnish Marston's spotty psychological reputation. Like she wanted him to be like recognized as this like really good person for like psychology. So she would write columns about him, and she would come like, and basically she would pretend to be like this New York reporter who trekked out to the suburbs to sit at the knee and absorb the wisdom of this great lie detecting Dr. Marston in his home, which was her home. And while she did, you know, while his kids, which are also her kids, frolicked in the yard, like, you know, a quote from one of these articles was, "The children spied me first and drew back as children do in the presence of a stranger."
That's how social media fake. This is what I'm talking about. Back then, she was promoting the way
she was an influencer.
She's like an influencer.
Yeah, she was.
Like,
she was.
Line
it was
of
all
people.
Totally fake. So again, fake. You know. But, you know, again, like I said, by all accounts, it seems...
This guy was ahead of his time, man.
He was.
Him and these three women.
He was.
Or
I mean,
two women,
they were,
whatever.
They were.
Well, actually, the other one really didn't get involved as much.
No, but you can find articles about her and how she influenced Wonder Woman too, right? Because she was, like, this free bird, free spirit. But anyway, so, like, you know, they lived in harmony. Because, like, even after his death... Olivia and Sadie, they continued living together, and they lived together until Olivia died in 1990 at the age of 86. And Elizabeth, Sadie, she died in 1993 and was 100 years old. So they really got to see the evolution of Wonder Woman. And so, like, again, I know I gave you a long history of William Moulton Marston, a.k.a. Charles Marston. But I think knowing his backstory is important to better understand how Wonder Woman came into fruition. So in an October 1940 interview with the Family Circle magazine, yes, that's the same magazine Olivia wrote for, William Moulton Marston discussed the unfulfilled potential of the comic book medium. So, and after reading this article, which again, you have to understand, Olivia was really keen on raising Marston up, the comic book publisher Max Gaines hired him as an educational consultant for the National Periodicals and All American Publications. These two companies would eventually merge to become DC Comics. So at the time, Marston really wanted to create his own superhero. He became, you know, stuck on this idea of a new kind of superhero who would triumph not with fists or firepower, but with love. Which is like, I mean, that's kind of beautiful. Like, to me, that's Jesus, but anyway. So anyway, it is reported that his wife Sadie's response was, okay, fine, but you better make her a woman. And Marston introduced the idea to Gaines, and he was given the go-ahead. And Marston developed Wonder Woman, whom he believed would be the a model of that era's unconditional, liberated woman. So again, you have to understand this is like during World War II, the men are off fighting, women are, you know, they're like keeping the home front going in factories and stuff. So this was a really important time for Wonder Woman to come into being, because really for the first time, women weren't out of the home, they were working. And he kind of understood that little girls lacked strong female role models, you know, because of the women in his life. And, you know, he decided to create a strong positive role model for both boys and girls. And Charles's experience with the polygraph had convinced him that women were essentially more honest than men in certain situations, and they actually could work more efficiently. So he definitely used his experience and his relationships with these women in his life as muse to create Wonder Woman. They were all the inspiration behind Wonder Woman. For example, Charles drew inspiration from the bracelets that Olivia often wore for Wonder Woman's bracelets. And, like, I can just remember as a kid going, pew, 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 when I would watch Diana Carter. Diana, yeah, right? Mm-mm. What was her name? I don't know. She's Mm-mm. Fine Me Like Me. Oh, my God. Anyway, the 1980s show, like, with Wonder Woman. That's the Wonder Woman I first remember. I didn't even know she was a comic book hero as a kid. So, as I said earlier, you know, Wonder Woman debuted in December, January.
Linda Carter, Nicole.
Huh?
Linda Carter.
Linda Carter. Yeah. Diana is, like, Wonder Woman's name. So, anyway, so Wonder Woman was scripted, and she was debuted in 1941, and she, you know, Charles Marston designed Wonder Woman to be an allegory for the ideal love leader, the kind of woman he believed should run society. In a 1943 issue of the American Scholar, Charles wrote, "Frankly," and this is a quote, "frankly, Wonder Woman is psychological propaganda for the new type of woman who I believe should rule the world." He wrote, "Not even girls want to be girls, so long as our feminine archetype lacks force, strength, and power. Not wanting to be girls, they don't want to be tender, submissive, peace-loving as good women are. Women's strong qualities have become despised because of their weakness. The obvious remedy is to create a feminine character with all the strength of Superman, plus all the allure of a good and beautiful woman." So again, you can kind of see like the dichotomy of like, you know, like traditional misogyny and like, you know, feminism with him. So Wonder Woman was a hit. Like, people really loved that she was strong and fierce, but also compassionate. And I mean, we can't forget that she was sexy because sex sells, right? So at the back of the Wonder Woman comics, and this is probably like the coolest thing ever, like, this is my favorite part about this entire story, is that Charles included a mini comic called Women in History. And these mini comics covered actual real life feminine heroes. So these kids could learn about real women doing real things in the real world, like that's awesome. Because again, we have to remember that kids back then, they didn't have access to handheld computers where they could just Google badass women. And, you know, Wonder Woman was successful. The golden age of Wonder Woman is considered to have taken place between 1941 and 1947. And during the golden age, Wonder Woman was an Amazon champion who, you know, wins the right to return Steve Trevor, a United States intelligence officer whose plane had crashed on the Amazon's isolated homeland, to man's world, and to fight the crime and evil of the Nazis. And during this period, Wonder Woman joined the Justice Society of America as the team's secretary. I was like, really, secretary? But again, you know, that's, I guess.
That's the 1950s
for you. 40s for you. And so, yeah, I mean, that was the job women held, right? Like, so anyway, again, but this is irritating because, like, he was married to women who were lawyers and, you know, I don't know. Anyway, the Golden Age ended in 1947 with Charles Marston's death. He died just before his 54th birthday of cancer. And so, like, after his death, his wife, Sadie, she wanted to take over writing of Wonder Woman comics. She had helped create them, and she, honestly, like, I mean, no one knew him better, right? So she probably would have been the perfect person to take over writing Wonder Woman. But the job went to a man, and his name was Robert Kaniger. And he took Wonder Woman.
He lived in the basement. The kinky guy.
Right? And so, like,
I'm kidding, though.
No, he didn't. So he took Wonder Woman into what is known as the Silver Age. And this took place between 1958 and 72. And this, during the Silver Age, Wonder Woman's origin was revamped along with other characters. Her new origin story increased the character's Hellenic and mythological roots, where she received the blessing of each deity in her crib. Diana would be destined to be as beautiful as Aphrodite, wise as Athena, strong as Hercules, and swift as Hermes. So by the end of the 1960s, now we're under the guidance of Mike Sekulowski. And okay, Wonder Woman, she surrendered her powers in order to remain in man's world rather than accompany her fellow Amazons to another dimension. Wonder Woman began using...
Why
this happened? So, okay, there was these things called comic book codes, and basically it was because they were afraid communism would get into the comic books. So they had to take away things like weapons and supernatural powers and things like that. So, Wonder Woman began using the alias as Diana Prince. She opens up a mod boutique, so she's selling clothes. And she, I know, she acquires.
But the one that I just saw not too long ago, she worked at the Smithsonian.
Right.
And she's like, yeah, an antiquity
expert. She's smarter. So anyway.
Antiquity expert in the Louvre. And then, I mean, like, what?
But her fashion sense is awesome.
But, well.
Probably because she had a mod. She had a mod store back in the 60s.
Boutique store.
So anyway, she acquired during this time a Chinese mentor named Ching, which again, like, that sounds just so racist to me.
Let me get this straight. So
I know it was against communism. I know. I know. This is like so, and I'm totally confused by it, but that's what
I
read.
All right, I'm tracking.
So who this, you know, this mentor taught Diana.
So my favorite martial part of arts. So far is like
and weapon skills. So
let's fight fascism, communism, and
I know.
And what else? How far can we go? With this? Feminism, yeah. Fascism, feminism, communism. But as you keep reading on, it's like, oh yeah, we had to take away weapons. We had to hide it. Yeah, it's all good.
So Diana engaged in adventures that encompassed a variety of genres, from espionage to mythology. The phase of her story was directly influenced by the British spy thriller, The Avengers, and Diana Rigg's portrayal of Emma Peel.
Oh, you said she was a founder of the Avengers?
No. Like, they were influenced. Like, the stories that the comic books had during this time, they were influenced by...
No, but what I'm asking is, was she like... So, Justice, like, for example...
League. Justice League, I think.
So, yeah. Okay, so it's like, for example, Marvel. By the way, we're not sponsored by Marvel or the Detective Comics.
But if they would like to sponsor us.
We will not deny. We'll
Okay.
Well, so kind of like Nick Fury, he put together kind of like that team, like the Marvel team or whatever. I forget the name of the team.
I don't read comic books.
I forgot the name of the team. Yeah, but you're over here reading Wonder Woman.
I never read Wonder Woman. Honestly, my whole love of Wonder Woman is because of Linda Carter, which I didn't even remember her name. Like when I was little, like that was my favorite show when I was like, I don't know,
so,
5 or 6. So anyway, okay.
So the Justice League, she's like a founding member. Okay.
Right, and then she became their secretary.
Yeah, right?
Right.
How that works?
Well, they revamped her story.
Oh.
In the Silver Age.
So they took her away from the role of the leadership role, yeah, and made her a secretary. Like Money Penny in James Bond.
Because misogyny.
Like Money Penny in James Bond.
So the Silver Age is considered trash by many
I concur with that statement.
Many Wonder Woman enthusiasts. Yeah, because I concur with that statement. As you just pointed out, they removed a lot of the feminism ideology that Marston wanted her to encompass. They also removed the woman, blah, blah, blah. They also removed the women in history section of the comic and replaced it with something called curious courtships. So instead of teaching young girls about real women in history and feminists, they switched it to talk about dating and stereotypical feminine things, again, I'm thinking that's exactly what Olivia was writing about back in the day. So it's like karma, I guess. I don't know. So during the Silver Age, Wonder Woman lost her powers, and she basically became a secret agent who basically was like the sidekick of a man. And she, you know, and again, that was because of this thing called comic codes, and it was created because, you know, they wanted to make sure no communism got into the comics, as I mentioned, and essentially misogyny. So in short, the Silver Age took out all the good things that made Wonder Woman a badass. So then you enter into the Bronze Age. And this began with the request of another feminist icon, Gloria Steinem, to bring back the original storyline of Wonder Woman. Gloria founded the magazine called Miss Magazine. And in 1972, she featured Wonder Woman on the cover. And she stated that the original Wonder Woman embodied everything the feminist movement was trying to bring to the mainstream. She argued that Wonder Woman was a symbol of strength and self-reliance for women because she promoted mutual support among women, but also promoted peacefulness and esteem for human life. Esteem for human life. And these are all the things that everyone should want. I couldn't agree with that statement more. So the Bronze Age of Wonder Woman brought back the original storyline, which included her being from the Amazon race and all the women and the all-woman island. And she had her magical powers again. They also introduced...
Well, because of men, she lost them. That's the reason why they hate us. That's why they will kill you if you find... That's why, yeah, the Amazonian women will...
Well, no, they won't. That. No, they don't. They won't kill you. Like, it's really cool, actually. I'll get into what they do. So they also introduced her twin sister, who was a black character named Nubia. And historically speaking, she is DC Comics' first black female superhero. And I would love to see a Nubia and Wonder Woman, like, movie with Gal Gadot. I think that would be,
Gadot.
Did I say it wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you for correcting me. So, okay. Now, if you're wondering how they are twins, because I think maybe you would... Nubia was Wonder Woman's black sister. She was created from black clay, just as Diana was created from white clay. Both were brought to life by Aphrodite.
I don't think she was created from white clay. I thought she was created from that earth clay. What was it called? That
white clay.
Is it white clay? I thought it was that strong Mediterranean clay.
Well, it was white. Like, you know, they have black sand and white sand. So, again, this is what I found. So Nubia, and it was from like the Wonder Woman Wikipedia. or the wiki. So Nubia was stolen by Ares or Mars. The Greek and Roman names were interchangeable, and more often than not,
Mars is
the Roman. It was Roman
Greek god.
So the Roman names were used. Mars was one of the gods whose Roman. Okay, yeah. So Nubia did not get the powers that were given to Diana, because she was kidnapped. Mars raised Nubia to be his warrior. He gave her a special ring, which kept her mind clouded. But years later, Diana met Nubia when she became her roommate. And after several battles, Wonder Woman was able to release Nubia from Mars's control when she used the heat of the sun reflected off her bracelets to cause the ring to expand and fall off. Nubia defied Mars and opted to lead her warriors to the Way of Peace. It was then that Queen Hippolyta, revealed the truth that Nubia was in fact Diana's sister. So after the Bronze Age, we moved into what is the Modern Age, which is where we are right now. And, you can see the movies about her and check out the comic books. And she's definitely a, much stronger character than she has been in the past. But, getting back to, her creator, Marston's beliefs led into his design of Wonder Woman mythology. He took the form of this masculine and feminine configuration, as well as dominance and submission, which were a part of his sexual fetishes, and he wove them into the mythology of Wonder Woman. An early example of bondage themes, which had probably been around since the beginning of time, but they were beginning to enter popular culture around the 30s, are seen in Wonder Woman. Themes of physical and mental submission appear again and again throughout Marston's comics work, with Wonder Woman and her criminal opponents frequently being tied up or otherwise restrained, and her Amazonian sisters engaging in frequent wrestling and bondage play. So these elements were later softened by writers of the series, but in other writings and interviews, Marston referred to submission as a noble practice and did not shy away from sexual implications, saying, "The only hope for peace is to teach people who are full of pep and unbound force to enjoy being bound." And one of the purposes of the bondage depictions in his comics, he stated, was to introduce eroticism to readers as a part of what he called sex love training, which, I mean, that's just kind of gross. Is that, what do they call it? What do they call it when abusers,
masochist.
No. Abusers, before they start abusing child, the grooming. Is that grooming? I don't know. So his Wonder Woman comics, he aimed to condition readers to become more readily accepting of love submission to loving authorities rather than being so assertive with their own destructive egos. About male readers, he later wrote, "Give them an alluring woman stronger than themselves to submit to, and they'll be proud to become her willing slaves." So Marston combined these themes with others, including restorative and transformative justice, rehabilitation, regret, and their roles in civilization. And these appeared often in his depiction of the near ideal Amazon civilization of Paradise Island. And especially its Reform Island, where it was like a penal colony, which played a central role in many stories that was a loving alternative to retributive justice of the world run by men. So basically at this Reform Island, the women of the Amazons would teach the men to be loving and not dicks. So some of these themes continued on in the Silver Age. Characters who may have been influenced by Marston are notably Saturn Girl and Saturn Queen, who, like Evilist and her female army, were also from Saturn. They are clad in tight red bodysuits, are also blonde or red-haired, and have telepathic powers. Stories involving the latter have been especially focused on emotions involved in changing sides from evil to good, as were the stories from Green Lantern's Blackest Night. And if you remember, I mentioned that he did write a book on human emotion. And so it's probably this emotional spectrum in these comic books were probably likely influenced by Marston's research into emotions. And Wonder Woman's golden lasso and her Phoenix girdle in particular were the focus of many of the early stories and have the same capability to reform people for good in the short term that Transformation Island and prolonged wearing of Venus girdles offered in the long term. So the Venus girdle was an allegory for Marston's theory of sex love training, where people can be trained to embrace submission through eroticism. Again, the guy was into some kinky shit. So many writers, apart from Marston, or including Marston, they've depicted Diana Price in different personalities and tone. That of a worldly warrior, a highly compassionate and calm ambassador, and sometimes also as a naive and innocent person. But like what's remained a constant mainstay of her character is her nurturing humanity, her overwhelming belief in love, empathy, compassion, and having a strong conscience. I mean, she is a woman after all. And to my mind, these traits are really what make her the strong, fierce creature. You know, these characters are what make women strong, fierce characters, creatures that we are. So in the golden age of Wonder Woman, they adhered to the Amazon code of helping many in need, even like misogynistic people, and never accepting a reward for saving someone. So while conversely, the modern version of the character has been shown to perform lethal and fatal actions when left with no other alternative, which is exemplified in the killing of Maxwell Lord in order to save Superman's life, which I would solely completely support because I love Superman. Okay, and then I'm just going to close out with this little fact. So Wonder Woman, she'll have these phrases like great Aphrodite, great Hera, merciful Minerva, suffering Sappho. And these phrases, they were all contributed by Charles's wife, Sadie. So in the end, you know, they may not have gotten the recognition or she may not have been able to continue Wonder Woman's story. These women's contributions, they really held on and stood the test of time as far as who Wonder Woman is. So that's it. That's the really long-winded history of how Wonder Woman came to be.
Thank you for your well-researched topic.
16 pages of notes. Yeah.
Yeah. About that.
So anyway, if you've listened this far, thanks so much. We would appreciate a review. And do find us on Instagram, on Twitter, and say hello. And certainly share this podcast with your friends.
Yes, please.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Goodbye.